Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to this week's podcast. I've got a really cool episode this week. I've got Corey Taylor from Stone Sour talking about their new record, Hydrograd. I've got an interview from the archives with Mr. Buddy Guy, and then drumming legend Kenny Aronoff, who's on a killer new record by his band, Supersonic Blues Machine, with lots of great guitar players, and he's got some really cool stories to tell. Head on over to patreon.com/iHeartGuitar if you'd like to be a contributor to the costs of running the podcast and stuff. And you'll also get access to an exclusive feed where at the moment there's a live track from my band a few years ago and a 1 hour chat with Steve Lukather. More stuff coming up very soon. But in the meantime, leave a review, leave a star rating, spread the word on social media, and let's take over the world. Here is Corey Taylor. Now, this interview happened in July when the new record wasn't out yet and only a few tracks had been released. Media previews hadn't quite all gone out at the time, so the standard way of doing things is you hear the album in full before you do an interview, but unfortunately that didn't happen this time around, so we talked about what I'd heard and what we could expect. But it was a really cool chat, and Corey's a great guy and a hell of a performer live, so next time you get a chance to catch Stone Sour, do definitely check him out. The thing people are talking about a lot is that it, it's more of a rocky kind of album. I guess the last few records you've done with Stone Sour and Slipknot have been pretty fucking heavy, so is this like you balancing out the light and dark sides of the force or something?
I mean, we've always had a really strong foot in the rock, I've said for years that, people have really kind of had this misconception about Stone Sour, where they think we're a metal band that plays, that sometimes plays rock, where that's not the case. We're a rock band that plays everything, that's really been the core of what we've been for years. And, with this album, we're putting our money back where the mouth is, we're really starting to kind of get back to where we wanted to be in the first place, which was a good kick-ass hard rock band, So there are really great elements of hard rock all through this album. Like there's elements of just straight out rock and roll. There's hard rock, there's metal, there's punk, there's California fucking country on here. Yeah. There's all kinds of elements that really are just us not only strengthening what we've been doing for 15 years, but also expanding the musical dialogue that we've been trying to make in that time as well, So it's fucking fantastic, man. Like when you hear it, you'll understand. It's almost like, American baseball. Trying to explain American baseball to somebody is like, it's like trying to explain why a foot can't go where a hand does, you just have to see it to figure it out, that's what this album is. You have to hear it to understand it.
Yeah. Well, I think in a certain sense too, like the heavier stuff you've been doing, like as a musician myself, I know that playing really fucking heavy music is really cathartic, but playing rock and different styles is fun, and they're different sides of the coin. So Fabulous is one of the songs I've heard, obviously, and it's so damn eclectic. One of the things that really made me laugh was that my wife and I have a running joke where we add a little motherfucker into songs where it doesn't belong. And so when I heard you do that, I'm like, he's in on the joke too.
Right. That's funny because I do that all the time in my car when I'm singing.
Yeah.
I'll add an unnecessary motherfucker in where it just beats a little more,
Elton John or Steely Dan or something, you just slip one in there, it's great.
Oh, songs that I'm sure they would have gotten to the unnecessary motherfucker, but they were just too busy with the notes, so we provide that motherfucker for them.
Totally. So that song is really eclectic. How did it come together?
That song came together from Tooch and Roy jamming together. It was just one of those songs that when we heard the demo, we just all were like, holy shit, you know, and we arranged it. It took a little arrangement because it was originally just kind of in different spots, you know, like it had a totally different feel to it. But the riffs themselves all really had a great fucking vibe to it, you know. So I took it and kind of did my magic on it, you know, and worked it in with the kind of like the lyrics that the lyrics that were going on in my head and the different melodies and stuff. And really, it came together really quickly. So it was just a matter of just kind of arranging the puzzle so that the song fucking figured itself out.
Mm. It's really cool because you kind of, you know, the first few times you listen to it, you don't quite know what's going to happen next. You know, it kind of sets it up as, you know, this could go anywhere, and it does.
That's the cool thing, though, and I feel like a lot of music doesn't have that feeling anymore, you know, like, where you're kind of, you can't anticipate what's going to be, like, you know, what the next part is, you know, like, a lot of bands, you can almost write the riff in your fucking head that's going to come next before you've even heard the song all the way through for the first time, you know,
but
this song, it keeps you guessing right up until the fucking last minute.
Yeah. I mean, you listen to something like Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, and that song goes all over the place, and, you know, it's like, oh, suddenly it's a hippie ballad? Oh, suddenly it's the heaviest fucking thing of all time, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me about, I guess this is the first record, obviously, that you've written with Christian, after doing, you know, the covers and stuff. So what's it like working with that guy? What does he bring to the band?
Well, it's our first time working with Chow, too.
Oh, yeah.
Writing with him. Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, working with those two was, honestly, it was so, like, it was just effortless, you know? Like, we all, you know, the great thing is that it all starts with us getting along, really, really getting along, and we all hang out, we all talk, we love hanging out and just kind of talking shit and joking, and we're all such dorks that it doesn't really matter, you know? Like, so writing together is the same thing. Like, we just love what we do so much that we get excited when we hear what we're doing with the music, you know. Like, when I send something to the guys, I know that it's going to be a little, you know, it's going to feel the same, but it's going to be different, you know. And that's kind of the way we all were, you know, especially with Christian and Chow. Like, the stuff that they brought in was different, but it fits so well with what we were writing that we didn't even miss a step. Like, it was great, man. Like, we've all contributed musically in the past anyway, so we didn't lose any time whatsoever being creative.
Mm. And I also guess, since you have toured and recorded together with this lineup, you know, before the album, you've had time to kind of create a musical personality that is Stone Sour, but incorporates these guys naturally instead of trying to force them in.
Yeah, exactly. It really came together very organically, very naturally, you know, especially when we started playing the music live, like demoing the stuff live, you know, that really led to our decision to record the album live.
Yeah.
Because by that time we were so versed in the music that we were like, you know what, let's capture the energy. You know, we know the part, we know what we're going to be able to do, but let's capture the energy that we've always wanted to and really make something special. And that's where it came from.
I follow Jay Rustin on social media too, and he was posting, you know, shitloads of photos of, you know, stuff going down in the studio. It looked like you guys were having a ball.
We laughed every day. Like, yeah. It was so awesome.
Yeah. What's Jay like to work with?
Jay's just like us, man. Like, total dork, total rockhead, you know, total music, you know, just like a gearhead, you know, anytime people would start talking about pedals or heads, like one of us in the background would just go, "Nerd!" Like I just fucking such dick moments, you know? Like it was great. To me, Jay is the best in the business right now because his ears, his taste, like his track record speaks for itself. But with this album, he's really going to fucking show the world just how fucking good he is. We put together, for me, the best rock album in the last 10 years.
Yeah, sweet. I mean, he has such clarity in the way he does things. Like, every band sounds like themselves, but there's a clarity there. Like, you listen to that last Anthrax album, and they never sounded that good.
Oh, it's amazing. Like, those last two albums that they did with Jay are like their two best albums that they've ever done. For them to be doing that after over 30 years, like that just tells you A, how good Anthrax is, and B, how good Jay is, because they trust him, you know, like, and knowing Jay, you know, being friends with Jay and, you know, just getting to work with him on various projects and then finally doing this, he was the only person for the job for us, because we were going to produce this on our own. We were going to produce this like by ourselves, and then, you know, smartly we all went, you know what, we can do that, but it would be great to have that extra set of ears just in case, you know, and that fucking paid off in spades.
Yeah, sweet. I wanted to ask you, you had like a neck operation, yeah?
I did, yeah. Spinal.
Spinal operation,
actually, yeah.
Oh, man. Has that affected, you know, your range or anything? Like, I was thinking about how when Frank Zappa, like, got knocked off stage and broke his neck, and after he got rebuilt, his voice was, like, lower.
Yeah, it was weird. That didn't happen to me. It's only really kind of been a physical thing for me. But just because, you know, I'm just slowly but surely starting to kind of get my mobility back. And that's even after over a year, you know, it's been pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Luckily I didn't lose any, didn't lose any of my range. Actually, I got some back because I quit smoking over a year ago, and I'm actually starting to get my range back from that, which is really cool. You know, God, if I'd have known that, if that could have happened, I would have fucking quit 10 years ago, you know? But, I'm still kind of in the process of rehabbing and all that shit. And, I'm slowly but surely getting my body back. And it's a fucking pain in the ass, but, you know, I'm getting there.
Yeah. I don't think people realize how physical singing is, like singing and drumming, you know, if you're not in shape, you know, you're kind of fucked.
you can lose your chops like nobody's business, like, and not only lose your chops, but you can let your whole your talent go to fucking shit, you know, it can take you years to get that shit back. So about I'd say 6 years ago I started really starting to get, like, really keep myself in shape as much as possible. And, at my age, it's still a process, but, you know, it's, as long as it's fucking worth it, you know, you just keep trying, keep going for it, you know?
Yeah. Well, last week I saw Devin Townsend, and that dude has been, like, working out for the last year or so with his drummer, and I swear he's singing as well now as he did when I first heard him 20 years ago. You know, he's going for notes that he hasn't been going for in, you know, ages. So, you know,
And which says something, because he's fucking incredible.
Yeah.
You know, like, if he's not going for a note, it's because he knows he can't hit it, you know? And now for him to have that confidence back, holy shit, God, I'm about to go fucking see him live again.
Yeah, you know? I was stunned. You know, I've been to every tour since 1997, and I was like, fuck, something's really clicking for him right now.
Yeah, man, that's awesome.
Another thing I wanted to talk with you about is a few years ago, when you were down here for a Soundwave, I interviewed you and Josh about guitar and stuff. At Rod Laver Arena, we had a good old nerd out, you know. So I wanted to ask, you know, what are you up to guitar-wise at the moment? You know, what are you into?
I've got, on the road, I have three guitars that I'm using, really, which is I have a 2008 Blackbird, Gibson Blackbird, or Firebird, excuse me, Gibson Firebird, that has a couple of, it's got a couple of fucking, it doesn't have the factory pickups on, because we traded those out, put a couple of Seymour Duncans in it.
Oh, nice.
so it's got a nice little fucking, yeah, nice chunky edge to it, but it's got a really killer clean tone. Those guitars really have great clean tone.
Yeah.
I also have a 1987 SG out with me that smells like the dude who owned it, like, chain smoked around it for about 45 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's got the color. It's got the color. Unfortunately, it also has the smell. So I named it Keith. so I've got that out with me.
Yeah.
And I'll probably bring that down to the continent once we get down there.
Cool.
And I also have God, I can never remember how this is pronounced. Is it Framus or Framus?
I think it's Framus. I think it's Framus. Yeah, I've said the brand name to the guys from the company, and they haven't corrected me. So.
yeah. I'm thinking about working some magic with those guys. I have a Stevie Salas.
Oh, those are incredible! Yeah,
that I'm using right now. They're fucking pretty dope, dude. Like, I kind of want to use that bass and have them make a custom for me, but give it more of a hollow body vibe. That same shape, but give it more of a hollow body vibe.
Yeah.
And put a couple of humbuckers in it and see what happens. I think that could be a really fucking cool, because it plays amazingly. You know, it's got such fucking chunk to it. Like, it's really great. So those three I'm kind of rotating through and just kind of feeling out every night, you know.
This interview with Buddy Guy was done about 2 years ago as advanced promo for his appearance at the Blues Fest festival in Byron Bay. And it was also just a couple of days before his most recent album, Born to Play Guitar, came out. And it was around the time he appeared on The Tonight Show as well. This is the second time I've interviewed Buddy. And man, this guy, like, he has... such a way about him where he's so humble about his place in blues history and his influence and stuff. It's really beautiful to hear. And especially towards the end of this interview, we talk about the origin of the polka dot design on his signature guitar and his, Jim Dunlop wah-wah pedal and stuff. And it's the most beautiful, touching story. So I hope you dig it. Here's Buddy Guy.
Buddy, hey, how you doing? Really good. I've interviewed you once before, and it was a great chat, so I'm really excited to get to talk to you again. How was The Tonight Show?
Oh, same here.
How was The Tonight Show last night?
I beg your pardon? It was good.
Yeah?
I just sit in with the band. I didn't get a chance to do my, just like a solo with the new album, but I sat in and got a brace here and a brace there, so I don't have control of that, so I just was excited to sit in with the band, and as always, excited to, play somewhere where the blues is not being ignored, because
yeah.
A lot of places they don't play blues no more.
Yeah, well, I was listening to the album in the car this morning, driving my son to school, and he loves it, so...
give him a big hug for me.
I will. So I think the thing that really stands out to me about this album is just how joyful lots of it is. There are songs on here that are really happy and fun. And of course it's very much about the guitar. What does the guitar mean to you after all these years?
My life to that guitar. I came up the hard way, and the guitar was like a blessing to me. I was born on a farm. My parents were very poor. On a given evening, we didn't have radio or running water, and I could pick up the guitar and get some joyful noise out of it, even before I really learned how to play it.
Yeah.
And I had to walk off out in the fields by myself to keep from running and my sisters and brothers crazy, because before you learn how to play, you can imagine how acoustic guitar sound in a country house.
You were also a pioneer of the wah-wah pedal, and actually last night I was stepping on your signature wah-wah at band rehearsal. I've had that for about 6 or 7 years. When did you first discover the wah-wah?
Actually, it was a great guitar player named Earl Hooker, and he could play the slide better than anyone I ever heard. Mm. And I saw him with it long before Jimi Hendrix. But America wasn't ready for it. Even they weren't ready for Jimi Hendrix here in America, because he perfected more than anyone. Mm. And he had to go to England, and the British say, bring it on. And God knows what he would be if he was alive today.
Yeah.
Because that was the time. It reminds me when I was in chess trying to turn up the amplifiers and play the extortion notes, and Leonard Chess wasn't ready for it. But when the British heard it, they accepted it, and then the chess come back to me and said, man, come on back down there. We was too dumb to listen, but you had it all the time, but we wasn't ready for that.
Yeah.
So that wah-wah pedal with Hooker, he did a cut. I don't think I have it, because somebody always takes my record, called Wild Wild Blues, long before Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. Cool. So what guitars are you using on this record?
I'm using the most of the Strat. You know, I think I may have had a Gibson in there on one or two songs, but my guitar tech noted it down, because after I make an album, I wait for the public to hear it. You know, I can't, you know, I don't look at my album and say, let me play it. I think, what the late Willie Dixon used to do that, so I think we got one. I say, I'm not that good. I don't know. I wait till the public let me know if this record is good or bad.
Yeah. Well, I'm the public and I love it.
Well, I was waiting for you to say that. You know, and every time someone says that, you know, I love Australia. And, you know, if I could get a half million, a billion people like you, it would help me keep the blues alive.
I'm working on it. Like I said, my son loves it, so I've added one to that list. I've done my part.
How old are your son?
He's 9.
Oh, great. Those are the kind of people I'm trying to reach, because those are the kind of people that can keep the blues alive and all other kind of music alive, because you're here today and you're gone tomorrow. And that's what we talked, B.B. King and I talked about just before he passed away. Mm. Muddy Waters talked about it, and we all talked about it. I tell everybody who interviewed me now, why did it care? We used to be drinking and playing, everybody's in their good health. And we'd always talk about who goes first, please keep the blues alive. And a lot of radio stations, I don't know about Australia, just don't play blues hardly anymore. You know, you have to just hope you can have some kid run into it and like it. But because I don't know why they don't play it anymore, I can't get a simple, straight answer from a lot of the radio stations and the people I know.
Yeah.
Because here in America, most radio stations got program directors, and if they don't put my record, the program director don't put my record out there, it'll never get played.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because when you get a group of musicians together, no matter what style they play, they all can play the blues together. You know, it's like a common language, and it's something that you share together, like you show each other licks. You don't sit there with a book and learn it. And so it's natural for musicians to get together, and blues comes out.
Well, even though we don't share the licks, we call it stealing licks. We're playing something that I may have pretend I'm not listening to it, but I'm saying to myself, man, what did you play? I gotta see it. I'm fine, that's it.
Well, it's funny, because I was watching some videos of you last night, and there was one from a few years ago where you were playing Sweet Home Chicago with Eric Clapton, Johnny Winter, John Mayer, Jimmy Vaughan, And there was a point where the camera was on someone else, but I could hear you throw in a lick, and I knew it was you. You know, your voice on guitar is so distinctive. Was there a moment when you kind of realized you had your own voice?
No, not at all. You know, the greatest guitar player I think that ever bent a string on a guitar just passed away a couple of months ago, B.B. King. And we were talking, and I told him, I said, man, you can blindfold me and hit one note, and I know it's B.B., he said. And I know you every time I hear you too, buddy. I said, I didn't know I had that, because he invented that vibrating of that left hand.
Yeah.
And right today, we have a magazine here that's come up with the 100 best guitar players, and they did not have him at the top, and I want to know why, because he created the style that we all play. I don't care if you call it rock, whatever kind of music they have named it. That's the 1950s. They start separating us, calling us rock stars, blues stars, and whatever it is. But before that, we all was R&B player. We didn't have the Chicago sound or the Motown and Memphis and all that kind of stuff like that. We was just R&B guitar player, R&B keyboard player.
I remember the first time I heard BB do that vibrato, and I was, you know, when you hear it, you don't know how on earth he does it, and then you see how he does it, and it's so unusual. No one would think to play it like that.
Right. And when I saw him do it, I said, man, you know, ain't nobody gonna ever fulfill your shoes. BB King, Muddy Waters, and the Howlin' Wolf. You may have a duplicate, but you never will have no one to fill those shoes, man. Because if you was interviewing the late Howlin' Wolf or Muddy Waters, man, I used to pat my feet when they were just talking to me.
Yeah. Well, I really love Come Back Muddy on this album. You know, it's such a... I mean, it could have been a sad song, and in some ways it is, but also it kind of takes you back to, I mean, it sounds like a damn good time, and I want to hang out with you guys.
Oh, man. My producer wrote that song, and I don't think he met Muddy, because he's a very young man, but he can feel you, man. I'm not the only person he produced. He can feel you, and he came up with that tune, and we had did two or three more, and we was mentioning Muddy, because I discovered this little young kid, Quinn Sullivan, and one of my albums, I think it's three albums ago or four albums ago, and he wrote a song about Who Gonna Fill Those Shoes.
Yeah.
And I called this little kid in, and he was like 9 years old, and that's him, Quinn Sullivan, playing some of those licks on that album. I don't forgot what you call it, but I don't know if you have it, but he's 16 years old now. I've never seen anybody play a guitar like that at 7 years old.
Yeah. Well, I started at 8.
So, let's see. I wanted to also ask about Wear You Out. That's a heavy song, you know. I listen to some rock and metal that doesn't have a deeper groove in it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, we were playing, my producer, Tom, and I was trying to say, okay, buddy, we ran it as a blues player, but let's let the world know you can play something else is blues, but it's still MUSIC music, and hopefully that a song like that might make some of these big radio stations, which quit refuse to play blues, they might say, well, we got something here. Well, I think we might have to play this, because this is, you know, right up there with the big super groups, which you do play, when which you refuse to play, because the Buddy Guy is branded as a blues player, regardless how I play a rock type guitar, they still brands me as a blues player. That means I'm not qualified to be played on these big stations that maybe I could sell two or three more albums.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Peter, this is your tuning
wrap-up. Okay, well, last question, since this is a guitar magazine, I really should ask a little more about guitars. I understand you have a new Stratocaster coming out soon.
No, I don't have a new one. You know, I got the polka dot one then, and that's the polka dots, because that's in honor of my mother, who never saw me play. There's a long story behind that. I just had promised her that I was going to buy a polka dot Cadillac to make her feel better, because she had a stroke and had never saw me play, and I knew I was lying to her. So I finally got the guitar company to make me the polka dot guitars, and they sold a few of them. And that's an honor of her, because she never saw me play.
Yeah.
I mean, she saw me with the acoustic guitar, but she never saw me play after I left Louisiana and came into... matter of fact, she never did see me play when I was in Louisiana. She had a stroke before I left, and I had made no records. I made two records. And after I got to Chicago, which this year would be 58 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it must feel good to see people like me using the wah-wah with the dots on it, and people with the guitars, knowing that that little connection still lives on now.
Well, thank you very much, and whatever support you can give it, I certainly will appreciate it.
Yeah, I certainly will. Thank you so much for your time, buddy. It's been great to talk again.
Please come and see me whenever I come back to Australia. I love playing it.
I definitely will. Thank you.
So now we've got Kenny Aronoff. You've heard this guy all over the place. John Mellencamp, Bob Dylan, Tony Iommi, Jefferson Airplane, Elton John, Santana, Chickenfoot, Smashing Pumpkins, on and on and on. His band, Supersonic Blues Machine, has a new album called California Sound, which has guest appearances by Steve Lukather, Eric Gales, Robin Ford, and Walter Trout. You can also see Kenny in the documentary Hired Gun, where he talks about his career as a sideman, and he's joined by all sorts of cool people, Jason Hook, Nita Strauss. It's a really great doco. So here we go, Kenny Aronoff.
First thing we should talk about is I want to get into the kind of theme or feel of the record, because I understand it was kind of written with the idea of California and that beautiful trip down the coast in mind. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the whole idea was back in the 60s, later 60s, 69, 70, there was all kinds of music on the radio at the same time. You know, you'd hear Santana, then you'd hear the Beach Boys, then you'd hear, you know, the Doors, and you'd hear Hendrix, and you'd hear the Stones, and you'd hear the Beatles. And there was a lot of, you know, Sly Stone, James Brown, there was blues, there was, and this that's a certain part, well, it's a certain part of the personality of this record is just that, you know, that we have a diversity of sound and diversity of sound and style of music, and then also it had that kind of improvising, free kind of spirited vibe that was coming out of 69 and 70, a lot of experimentation. I picture myself driving up the coast, you know, listening to all these different types of music, all on the same radio station. So that was some of it. The I recorded five songs first by myself, then recorded another 10, five more, another two more, and maybe another one. And I was trying to, after the first batch, I tried to then listen to that, and I tried to take it to the next level on the next batch. So the album had a lot of diversity. You know what I'm saying? Mm. And the lyrics are also of that time. You know, it's kind of, the songs about love, there's, honesty, type of vibe that came out of that time, you know?
Mm. Well, it's interesting. As a kid growing up in Australia, California seems like this mythical place. But when I finally started going there for the NAMM show every year, something really hit me, which is, oh, suddenly all that music makes sense, because it feels like the way this sunshine feels, you know? And there's seems intangible until you get there, and it's like, oh, no, I totally get this.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I grew up on the East Coast. And then I was living in the Midwest for a long time, you know, playing with John Mellencamp. And, when you come to California, it's funny how the music that you heard that came out of that era sounds like that place. Even the jazz in California sounds different than the jazz in New York.
Mm.
Totally different thing.
Yeah.
The coolness, more cool feel, sunshiny vibe, laid back vibe. It comes out of California versus New York, which is a little bit more intense in your face.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Now, being a guitar nerd myself, this record is full of some great guitar work, and you've obviously played with a lot of greats over the years. Lukather is a guy I know pretty well, and he's just, he's got so many great stories. What's he like to work with opposed to, shoot the shit with?
Which guitar players do I like to work with?
Oh, no, I mean, like, Steve Lukather, what's he like to work with? Like, I know what he's like to interview, and he's hilarious.
He's a good friend of mine. He lives right up the hill from me.
Yeah.
I'll go up there and have coffee with him. The thing, we used to do a lot of sessions together. We've been friends for a while. It might be, not since the 80s, you know. We've been through this whole music business together. And, He was always, oh my God, so funny, and what a character, and always, total lovely guy, but really knows music, but also brutally honest too, man. It's like if you bullshit, he'll call you on it, and then obviously an amazing player. But I recorded that song I had to lay down the parts before he did, but because I know his style of playing and I know him, I kind of played to an imaginary solo that he was going to do. And I toured with all these guys, Supersonic, or played live gigs with them. So I was putting in fills, imagining the solo he was doing, with the idea that when he played with me. Overdubbed, he would feel like we were playing live together. Yeah, I think that's the effect it had on
him. Mm, that's so cool. I've always wondered about.
I've been on so many records. I've been on 300 million records.
Yeah.
I've got 1,300 gold, platinum, diamond records, 60 nominated, 1 Grammy Awards. I know how to do sessions. Mm-hmm. I know how to work. And, the thing is, I've worked with, it's not just rock, it's been everywhere from, B.B. King to Benny Gibbons to Smashing Pumpkins to, Santana, Rod Stewart, Mellencamp, Melissa Etheridge, Celine Dion, all the girls, Melissa Etheridge, Avril Lavigne, Alanis Morissette, then Johnny Cashman, then Nelson Christopher Dalverson, then there's Dr. John, then there's, Leonard Skinner. I mean, it's just stylistically all over the map. And what comes out of that is I learned a lot about different types of music, different ways of playing the drums, knowing how to get along with all these different types of people. It's not just about playing the instrument. That's just a piece of it. It's knowing how to solve problems. It's knowing serving the song. Serving the song, doing what's right for the song, getting out of your ego, put it down aside, and serve the song or the artist you're working for.
Well, you know what? The first time I became aware of you, I was 12 years old, and I saw your name listed in the credits on the Blaze of Glory soundtrack. And for me, for me, as a kid obsessed with music at that age, I would look at these liner notes and think, who is that guy? I'll file that away. And so you see these same names pop up over and over again, And so that's why I was so excited when I saw the Hired Gun documentary was, it's like, we get to hear more of your story. We get to hear, Ray Parker Jr. I had no idea about half the stuff he'd done,
Yeah. Oh, well, you haven't heard half of it. That's why we're going to make a new one, a new movie with the same guy, Fran Stein. It's going to be Ray Parker Jr., me, Jay Graydon, Steve Lukather, Dean Parks, and a whole bunch of other people, David Foster, that are going to explore. We're going to get to really go into the thousands and thousands of records we've made and what changed and And, you know, man, I got a full thing in my autobiography, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, how, God, I mean, you used to build all these sessions. You had to be able to play your instrument. I mean, there was no, the very least, there was punching in. But they didn't really want you to punch in as a drummer. So you had to have your groove, your time, your parts, your sound, everything. Perfect. One take after another.
Mm.
That's the way I was trained. There was no Pro Tools, fix this, move that, not in that day. And you didn't want to be the guy that's throwing the session up, then they have to punch you in, then all of a sudden your hi-hats aren't open as much as they were when you were playing, so now you're slowing the session down. You had to be perfect. And that trained me to be a great musician. And everything is a complete take. Yeah, I mean, and so they we want to talk about that kind of thing. And in 2005, right about then, I came in to do a Michelle Branch record, and nobody warned me, but I became very apparent that everything I was playing to was a final keeper part. Mm. So he had three or four different guitars on the right speaker, three or four on the left, keyboards, vocal backgrounds, percussion, loops. And so I had to figure out on the spot how to tune my drums, what to do to the drums, what size drums to use to fit into this huge wall of sound. And it suddenly became the thing where I wasn't, they weren't building around the drums, around the frequencies of my drums or my feel of my parts. I had to play around them, but still sound like I was leading the whole thing. You know, I still sound like they had recorded, we'd all recorded together. That's a serious art form.
Yeah.
So these are some of the things we're going to talk about. How everything changed, what went on during the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010 years, or decades.
Yeah. Well, I often feel that Pro Tools itself isn't the enemy, it's the screen. A lot of problems come when people look at that screen and start to wonder about, you know, oh, we didn't quite line up there. And it's like, no, but that, the fact that you're not all hitting one at the same time.
Close your eyes and use your ears.
Uh-huh. So one thing I've always wondered is, who had it worst in terms of the amount of gear they had to bring to sessions back in the day?
the amount of gear?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well, with me, I used to bring, like, you know, 50, 70 snare drums, you know, 6 bags of cymbals, you know, a main drum set, but a couple of backup sets. Oh, my God, they had a huge truck. But back then, there were budgets, so they would, you know, deliver, set up, and then I would, I could pick and choose. We'd also be in the studio for maybe 2 weeks sometimes, you know. And with the budget change, we simplified everything.
Well, that looks like our time up, so thanks for the chat. It's been great to finally meet you after all these years, and I'm sure I'll catch you around.
Absolutely. All right, man. Good luck with your podcast. Thank you.
Cheers. See ya.
Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next week. Patreon.com/iHeartGuitar. See ya.